A primer on constitutional thinking, next on Principles and Policies. Welcome to today's edition of Principles and Policies. I'm your host, Barry Sheets, the Executive Director of the Institute for Principled Policy. And along with me today is our co-host, the Vice Chairman of the Institute, my fellow analyst and very good friend, Chuck Michaelis.
Hello to the folks out there in WLRY land. It's great to be back with you, and it's great to be back with you also, Barry, as always.
It's an excellent time to be alive, Charles. It is, as we record this, it's Election Day. Honestly, I've heard that sometimes, I think Congress was trying to make this a national holiday to see if they could improve voter turnout. Now, from what we've been hearing today so far, Chuck, that isn't happening, and probably most people would just take the Monday off and make it a long four-day weekend and come back from Aruba and still not vote.
Well, you know, when you think about it, there's a reason we vote on the first Tuesday after the first Sunday in November, but it's not because it's prescribed by the Constitution or by some kind of federal law.
No. Nope.
Yeah, the federal law sets the federal election. The only reason the states also do it on the same Tuesday is just for the sake of uniformity. There's no reason why it has to be the first Tuesday after the first Sunday in November.
Well, you know, I think that the old argument that we change the clocks that first weekend in November so that we've got more daylight, it gets lighter earlier in the morning and gets dark earlier in the evening, and that was supposed to be for the little kiddies in the fall and the winter, you know, waiting for the school buses. But really, it was just to give people more time to make excuses for not going to the polls. Because honestly, Jacob, what I was going to say is we've been tracking a little bit here, and in Franklin County and in Columbus, it looks like the voter turnout is projected to be somewhere in the neighborhood of a hale and hearty 11% this year. Now, granted, this isn't what we call an off-year election. 2013, there are no statewide, there are no federal candidates on the ballot, and this year there are no statewide issues that voters have to go and make decisions on at the polls. No constitutional amendments, no referenda on legislation, etc. What we have is just pure local politics, Charles. Local levies, local school board candidates, local trustees, local city council races, what have you.
Yeah.
It's all politics is definitely local in this election. The big problem is when you don't have a big marquee name with lots and lots of name ID and or media pushing people, most people forget that the first Tuesday after the first weekend in November is actually an election year, unless they're a candidate, they are intimately connected in some way to a candidate, or their ox is the one that might be gored if a certain ballot measure either passes or fails on this election.
Well, a lot of people don't realize the importance of some of the offices that are up today. For instance, I was thinking in terms of my own city here in Westerville. This is a city council election. Everybody goes, city council, how much damage can they do? Folks, they can do a lot of damage. Let me tell you something. There are candidates out there who are four square behind things like sustainable development that is a direct assault on your property rights.
Mm-hmm.
That's right. Why you need to care about local elections and who gets elected. Actually, there are, I think, seven candidates on the Westerville ballot for city council. There are four seats open.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
And I'm only voting for one candidate.
And that's your prerogative to do so, although you could cast four different candidates on one ballot. Just because you can vote for more than one doesn't mean that you have to, or in many instances, should vote for more than. And sometimes there may not be any candidates, regardless of how many options you have, that meet the criteria for being a good local leader. Now, you know, I'm not saying perfect. Let's make sure we're clear on that. You know, we're not holding to a standard of absolute perfection. What we're holding to is a standard of meeting the minimum, well, in our respect, biblical requirements of being someone above reproach who's not, enticed by bribery and who fears God. Those are the basic minimum requirements, Chuck. It's sad to say in this culture that many of our candidates don't measure up to one or more, if not all of those base criteria. But when you go vote, that's the reason why you should do your homework. You should, you know, at least try to find out as much as you can about the candidates that you will be either voting for or against. And, you know, do your homework. Now, in my local race, I went this morning and I kind of laughed because, number one, there was only one other person in there voting. Granted, this was like at 8:30 in the morning. There was only one other person in there voting. And when I got to open my ballot up, there were only three races in my local community, in my precinct that I was in, that I could vote on. One was township trustee, one was city school board, and one was the county school board. And in each one of those, it was like, vote for not more than X number, and that's exactly how many were running. So, you know, it was basically check all the boxes, and that was your complete ballot if you just wanted to fill the spaces.
Well, you know, some people think that that means a shoo-in, but in some states, they have a setup where if there are two candidates and two seats, but one candidate does not get 50% of all the votes cast, they don't get seated.
Yeah, we don't have that in Ohio.
I wish we did.
I know. But we've not put that in there. So basically, one vote can get a candidate into office. Now, Think about that, ladies and gentlemen. Now, this may be a candidate who's representing a small handful of people, like in a township, like in my township, where there's probably not more than 1,000 people in the township, okay? But still, if one voter can determine who for the next 4 years is going to be making spending decisions and taxing decisions for everybody else, I'd like to see 501, you know, votes being cast to say that at least a majority believe they were the right person for the job.
Yeah.
But that's not how we do it in Ohio. Basically, if we have you have X number of seats open and only X number of candidates file, and that those two X's are equal to each other, then pretty much they consider that both candidates are going to win.
As long as they get one vote, and the chances of that candidate not showing up to vote for himself are pretty close to nil. It could happen.
It could happen, but I doubt if it does.
We have a friend through IOTC who won an election, though he died.
Oh yes, you're right.
He had died in between the getting on the ballot and the election, and he won.
And he won. Yes. Well.
An odd situation to say the least, but nonetheless, that kind of thing happens.
Well, that's usually when after the election, the party or the county office appoints somebody
to
fill the seat.
Well, sure. So. We have a situation here where we have a local school board election, and we have eight candidates running. I think it's eight.
Mm-hmm.
We have four who are basically not interested in running things the way they've been run up to this point, which is badly. And we have four candidates who are business as usual, basically, which is the teachers union calls the tune, and the school board dances and gets out there and makes sure that we get a levy on the ballot, and that, boy, we got to raise those taxes. Well, let me tell you something, folks. I sat down and calculated what my tax bite is. I think the national average of tax bite in the United States is something like under 1.5%. I think it's like 1% of assessed value is the national average. We're at 2.7 here.
Ouch! That's a bit more painful of a bite now, isn't it?
It's a lot painful of a bite, and we have a
now. When you say of assessed value, ladies and gentlemen, what he's talking about is the percentage for each $100,000 of assessed value, because that's usually how mills are figured, is based upon the every $100,000 of valuation of your property.
Yeah, what is it? Well, the formulas are so complex in Ohio anymore because of the whole
well, you have what they call the 920 formula, which was to basically keep people from being run out of their homes as fast. said that basically that your property taxation had to be capped at 35%. So what you do is you take the millage times the number of hundreds of thousands of dollars that the property is valued at, and then multiply it by 0.35, and that determines your base tax rate or your base millage. Then you add in factors like there's a homestead exemption if it's your primary homestead, and I think that's like 2%. There's a senior reduction, I think, of 10%. And then if it's an agricultural use, you get a CAUV valuation of so many percentage points. But ultimately what it really gets down to is it's not so much on that. It's the inside millage. And we can talk about this at length, but that's not what we're here
for. That's not what we're here today.
You can go on our website at principalpolicy.com and find a 10-part article on replacement and renewal levies that starts talking about all these millage issues.
That's right.
And that's a little plug. So go over there at principalpolicy.com and read that. But what we really have, Chuck, is that most people vote for these tax levies, and they don't realize it because, well, many of them are not directly paying their property taxes. You know, they don't get a tax duplicate, and they have to write it and pay it in. It's figured into their mortgage payments, and so therefore...
Yeah, until their mortgage is paid off, they don't know what they're paying.
They don't
a month.
Know what they're paying a month, and then when they start getting those tax duplicates every 6 months or every year, depending on how much they pay up front of their property taxes, and that's when they start realizing, hey, wait a minute.
Well, I don't live in anything like a mansion, as Barry can testify to, since we're recording this on the back porch of my house.
Oh, I don't know. This is kind of a manse, Chuck.
Listen, folks, it's on the south side of Westerville. What does that tell you? This is not the ritzy area of town.
We could ask your wife. I'm sure she'd probably agree with your assessment.
We pay very close to $400 a month in property taxes here.
That's just absolutely insane, Charles.
It is. It's absurd. So in any case, we have these eight candidates, and four of them are basically for business as usual, and four of them are for changing the way things work.
Right. And the problem is that even though there's four seats open, there's what, seven seats on the board or nine?
There are three seats open.
There's three seats open. Okay, excuse
me.
And
I think there are seven.
Okay, so three of the seven. So that means no matter who gets in, whichever group or set of individuals gets in, they're still going to have to be dealing with people who are already there and most likely, my guess is, probably vote pretty much in lockstep with each other.
For the most part,
for the most part. Okay. Maybe there could be some coalitions formed, but see, there's the other thing. And you know, okay, we are going to talk about this a little bit. This will be the first half of the program. I'm sorry, ladies and gentlemen, but we got to talk about this.
Yeah.
One of the big problems that we have, Charles, and that is among constitutional, evangelical, Christian, conservative. You go down the laundry list of the adjectives you want to use. Their big problem is, and I'm saying this from many years of observation and engagement with this. Yes, they'll stand up for office. Some of them will. Yes, they'll run, and they'll do good things. Yes, some of them will even get into office. But usually what happens, and I've seen this time and time again, is they become what I call the Lone Ranger. They get on a board, and they're the only person who has their particular set of convictions on that body. But they immediately start making lots and lots of noises and demands and creating, shall we say, impasses that if they just waited a little bit, figured out how things actually worked and didn't work on the board, does that mean they have to vote for everything? No, it doesn't. It means that they should be wise and circumspect. They should be wise as serpents and innocent as doves. But I've seen it more often than not, Charles, where a candidate who's things like us, mainly, catches lightning in a bottle, as you might want to say, and they get on, say, their local school board. And I'm remembering one down in Warren County here not too long ago. Chuck, within 3 months of getting on the board, this candidate was getting national media attention because of digging in their heels about a position regarding creation and evolution, which, honestly, they had no support on the board to push. How effective do you think that candidate or that elected official was in moving their philosophy forward?
Well, they got
at that
nothing.
Point?
They got nowhere.
They actually fell back.
Yeah.
Because they gave their opponents lots and lots of ammunition. Honestly, and that's one of the things when we teach Institute on the Constitution, Chuck, we teach people how to be circumspect about this. You know, this didn't change overnight. It didn't get this way, didn't get bad overnight. This whatever, whether it's a school board or city council or whatever, didn't get to be quote-unquote corrupt or ineffective or unresponsive overnight. And it certainly isn't going to change overnight. Now, I hope for your candidates here in this, on the on their school board here locally, that they understand that, that even if they win the entire block, if all three of them get elected, or all three of the four of them get elected, that they're not going to be able just to walk into the first school board meeting, drop the gauntlet, and say, you know, it's a fight to the death.
They have a slight advantage in that there is one person.
Okay.
One who got elected on the last set of these, who has basically come out and said, you got to get me some support on this board, or I'm going to have to quit.
Yeah. And that's the thing. You've got to be able to persevere. That's the other thing candidates of our mindset have to remember. It isn't a microwave moment. It isn't going to happen if you snap your fingers. And you may have to suffer through some persecution quietly. And while you're at it, be smart. Start taking notes. Start counting votes. Start documenting things that are going on, including in executive sessions, Charles.
Yeah.
And then be very smart about it. When you need the help, that's when you start educating the voters about what's really going on.
Most executive sessions are a scam anyway.
Yes, they're a way to get out of the public eye while they vote on something that they've already, that a majority of them have already agreed on sitting at a dinner table at a Bob Evans or something.
Yeah, or you know, over coffee someplace or whatever. But you're right. One of the major problems is that we get one candidate in, and they actually don't do anything about building coalitions with the other side. They go in and they want to change things like right now. The payoff has to be now. And they don't buy their time and work to get some support.
No, they don't, because it's like they're on, I hate to say this, they're on a mission from God. And God has told them that they need to take that ground and take it yesterday. Chuck, God's never worked that way. Even with his children, the Hebrews, when he sent them into the promised land, I'm not giving this to you all at once. Why not? Because you can't handle it.
Well,
it was very clear in the Old Testament that it was going to take them at least 7 years to clean out all of the corruption and all of the paganism and all of the false gods and the false idols that had been built up in the promised land until God put them there. And he didn't say, go in. What did he do? He didn't tell him, go in there and start, just go straight to the major city and take it down and take the walls down. No, he said, you know, pick a few people, send them in, have them scout things out, come back, and then give an assessment. And we saw what happened with that. Most of them got scared and turned away, except for Caleb and Joshua, who were like, God's given it to us. We need to go in and start taking it.
Yeah, the land of milk and honey. Yeah, well, you're right. If you recall, God freed the slaves in a very short time. But then he made them walk around in the desert for 40 years.
That's right, because of disobedience.
Exactly.
And that's my concern with many of our good candidates. Oftentimes, they want to get ahead of God. And if God only put you on that board by yourself and you're outvoted 6-1, I'm not necessarily saying standing up and quoting, thus saith the Lord, is actually going to get you 4-3 votes.
Yeah.
But being wise and being a scribe... As God, if you notice, with all these things, there was always a scribe who could jot down what was going on for the kings or even for the prophets. I mean, you know, we didn't come about all these books of the prophets just because, you know, just because.
Right.
Obviously, it was through the, you know, administration of the Holy Spirit, but there was always somebody who was there who jotted down what was going on.
You got to be careful about your scribe too, because didn't Elisha have a scribe who attempted to go in after him and charge for his services? That didn't work out so well, as I recall.
No, it did not. Got to be careful of that too. So, but you know, Chuck, there's our key. And so, ladies and gentlemen, I know that most of you went and voted who are listening to us. I hope you went and voted on Tuesday, and I hope that you're not either too disappointed or overly optimistic with the outcomes, because even if your candidates got in, your candidates are going to have to take some time to get acclimated, especially if they're first-time candidates and they've not been in office before. They're going to have to take some time to kind of figure out what the lay of the land is around them, because I know I'm working with some city council people up in Delaware. Chuck, the election's over with on Tuesday. The following week, they get the next year's budget plopped down in front of them right after they get sworn in for a vote. Now, they'll have a week or so to look over it, but...
Over a budget for a whole city.
For a city's budget, and they've got like basically a week and two weeks in order to get up to speed on everything that's going on, including, well, where is the status of all these contracts, and, you know, what obligations do we have, what obligations are we not, you know, locked down to. It's going to be a lot of work. And I think that's done intentionally, because that way you get if you get some greenhorn candidate or elected officials, you know, winning ballots, you get them in there and pressure them to cast a vote because we have to have the budget. The city's got to keep operating. And then their opponents have something. Well, you voted for this. Well, you voted for that. You know, you said you were going to do this, but you did that. I see that. You know, that's
yep.
those are the pitfalls. But just having a biblical grounding and a constitutional understanding helps people. Because if you have a biblical grounding, you understand that God is a God who does things decently and in order. It's not rush jobs. It's not hustle, hustle, hustle. It's do what I tell you to do, and do it in the way and the time and in the order I tell you to do it. That's how God operates. And constitutionally, we know that, hey, you know, we can do that, we can't do that. Well, the federal government shouldn't be offering this because they don't have the constitutional authority to do this.
Right.
You know, those are the ways we start taking back liberty at the local level, you know. Don't just vote yay or nay on something because it's stuck in front of you. Have rationale. Understand why it is or isn't valid and be able to defend that. That's really what it gets down to, and that takes just some careful thought and planning. You know, these jobs may be part-time offices, you know, for elected officials, but really it takes conscientiousness in order to do it well and to do it in a way that protects liberty and the taxpayers and upholds our constitutional form of government.
Well, that again, you gave the positives. Unfortunately, so much of local government is the negatives, in that people basically like to be in there. So people see them they go down to Bob Evans. Hey, how you doing? Hail fellow, well met. Hey, by the way, I've got a little zoning issue. Do you think you might be able to help me handle that?
Oh, yes.
And of course, there are some times when you need to be involved in that, because zoning issues pop up all the time simply because the city councils have sort of sloughed off their responsibility for those issues into the lap of an unelected body, who then, because they're unelected and they're insulated, this is a common problem, and this has been a very common problem in Westerville. The city council then hides behind its zoning board. The zoning board will do something absolutely draconian, and then people go to city council and say, I want some relief. And, well, we can't go against our zoning board.
Oh, yes. No,
and the answer is, oh, yes, you can.
Yeah, that's right.
And you'd better. Now, usually that's not done in an open session.
Right.
You get with a representative and say, okay, you can either handle this, and this is a legitimate function of an elected representative who has oversight over that kind of a thing. You go to that representative and say, you're going to have to fix this. This is a busted system. I was involved in a church building project where essentially the law was broken. The city of Westerville held a building permit hostage until we actually ceded land to the city.
Oh, boy.
I kicked and screamed and begged and pleaded. I said, look, you can't let them do that. Oh, do you understand how... And I got the answer I got back was, do you understand how much they can delay this project? I said, you bet I understand it. But the fact is, if you let this go through, it'll be that much easier for the next church that wants to build. And the city wants some of their land.
Yep.
And that's exactly what happened. They went along to get along, and of course they lost use of over an acre of ground that got ceded to the city for a road that nobody wants. I actually had one of the sitting city council members come to the door, and I said, sorry, not voting for you. Well, why not?
Why not? Yeah, exactly.
So I sat down and told her the whole story. And she, and you know what she asked me? She goes, would you be willing to serve on a zoning or planning board? I go, yeah, sure. I'll make the application. You can make the recommendation, but you and I both know I'll never get on it.
Mm-hmm, probably
and the
not.
Reason I'll never get on it is because I'm a property rights advocate. Property rights advocates generally aren't allowed on zoning and planning boards.
No, no, because you would be the skunk at the garden party.
Yeah, and I'd also be a guy, one of the kind of people who would eventually use that office to run for elective office.
Uh-huh. Well, we can't
on
have
the basis
that.
Of what? What would I run on? What would be my platform, my major platform plank be?
Property rights.
Property rights.
Of course.
Protecting your property rights. Because right now, in most major cities, and this is what we started off with, you've got a sustainable development movement going on, which requires the surrender of your right to use your property in the way you see fit. Now, you know, if I wanted to sink an oil well in my quarter-acre lot, I could see how my neighbors might not like the noise and mess and trucks in and out of here. So I don't have a problem with zoning from that aspect. Where I have problems with zoning is if I go out in the middle of nowhere and buy a piece of property to do something with, and suddenly an abutter basically says, well, I don't think you should be able to use it for that.
Now, that's a problem.
And that's a problem. And that's what we're running into. We also have problems like is happening down in the Dayton area, where a city, or actually, it's not a city. It's a regional planning commission.
That's right.
And this is where people say, well, what's the city have to do with that? Regional planning commissions are multi-city areas, and the members of those boards are only responsible to the city officials who appoint them. But people don't know that. So what's happening in Dayton is basically property is being seized down there for things like bike paths, which are passing through within 50 feet of people's doors and ruining the value of their property.
Right.
Destroying trees, doing all kinds of things for the sake of having a bicycle path. Well, yeah, I get that bike riders have a lot of clout these days, although don't understand why, since they're really not paying additional tax. For instance, we've got a lot of roadways that are suddenly being marked as dual use that we have to share with bike riders. And I'm like, well, I will be kind and share because I have to. But the fact is that bike riders aren't paying road use taxes like I am.
Well, why not?
Yeah, because they don't buy gasoline.
Ah, well, isn't that just a rub there?
So that's the kind of thing you have to keep in mind. These are not simple little, well, he's my neighbor, so I'm going to vote for him. I've got a neighbor here. If he ran for city council, I would actively campaign against him. I'm not going to say where.
Yeah, I'm not going to say where or who.
No,
so, yeah,
or
that's
who.
Right.
But,
don't want to get into that.
Yeah, no, that's not the point. But the point is that, you have to be aware of what people are thinking about. That's why these little elections on off years are extremely important, because those kinds of offices have a lot of effect on what it is that happens to you and your kids.
That's right.
Through school board, through your property, what happens to your taxes, and basically, you know, whether your city council is going to rein in the local constabulary and make sure that they're not out there, you know, pulling little old ladies over for going 27 into 25.
Does that happen? Just kidding.
Yeah.
Just kidding.
Yeah.
I'm not that ignorant. But, you know, Chuck, again, this is one of these reasons why we do what we do. We teach Constitution. We teach it from a biblical standpoint. And we teach people not what to think, but how to think about these things. Because you can get into all of this if you just don't think, or if your thinking process is based on your feelings. I think, I feel, I believe, I hope. Just like Scripture, we have to go back to, as Christ did, it is written. This is the reason. This is why government can't do this. This is why government should do this. Those are the kind of things we have to get down to. Now, sometimes that's not as clean a process as people would like to see it.
Right.
And one of the things that we wanted to talk about today is a case that's coming before the United States Supreme Court that isn't clean cut. it's messy. It's one of those ones where the subject matter makes you feel one way, but the underlying constitutional issues behind it make you think another way.
Right.
And so what we're going to be talking about, ladies and gentlemen, in this segment is the case of Bond versus the United States. This is a case that has come before the United States Supreme Court, and they will be hearing this case now for the second time in this session of the Supreme Court, because, you know, the first Monday in November is when the court reconvenes.
First Monday in October.
October, excuse me. Why did I say November? Because we're thinking about elections and talking
about
November.
Thinking about elections, yeah.
First Monday in October is when the court reconvenes. So basically, today as we're recording this, the Supreme Court is actually hearing oral arguments in the case of Bond versus the United States. Now, what is Bond v. U.S.? Well, Chuck, just to give a little background on this case, the plaintiff is Carol Bond. Now, Carol Bond is not necessarily your poster child for... let's put it this way. She would not win a Miss Manners contest,
no.
Okay? You see, Carol Bond is a resident of Lansdale, Pennsylvania. And Carol Bond is one of the scariest of all creatures on the face of the earth, Charles. She's a smitten woman.
A scorned woman.
Scorned woman.
Yeah.
A woman who has had her man stolen from her by adultery. Okay? Basically, Carol Bond had a friend, and I use that term loosely.
Yeah, in quotes.
In quotes, who had an affair with her husband, and she found out about it. Well, what Carol Bond did next would seem to make sense in light of the scorned woman theory, if you understand what I'm saying. She decided to get even. And actually, she decided to one-up. This isn't even getting even. This is one-upping. So basically, she went to her place of employment. And I'm not sure where she was employed at. It's not clear from this.
It is in the past tense, however.
But it was in the past tense. And she obtained a substance, a chemical, which happened to be toxic. And it hurt. Tell it could be any kind. It could be some kind of cleaning thing or whatever. We don't know what the chemical was. I don't think she was spreading ricin or anthrax on anything, but she took this chemical that she got from the place where she was employed, and she dumped it on the car and the mailbox of her antagonist, of her ex-friend who had slept with her husband. Well, you know, she really wanted to mess this woman up. Okay, that's the reason why she did this. Well, didn't quite work out that way. But Carol Bond was arrested for this, you know. And the state of Pennsylvania was trying her on assault, as well as a couple other things. And that's when things got funny. Because then the federal government stepped in the middle of this, and federal prosecutors walked in and said, we're here to take over this case because, according to the federal prosecutors, Carol Bond had violated the Chemical Weapons Ban Convention of 1997. Okay, yes, that's right, Chuck. Her dumping whatever this substance was, drain cleaner or whatever it might have been, on her neighbor's car and mailbox, federal prosecutors decided that she was guilty of utilizing a chemical weapon. Of waging chemical warfare.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, Chuck, since we understand what the constitutional definition of what warfare really is, can one individual throwing Drano on the car of another individual count as engaging in chemical warfare?
Well, it depends on how the treaty is worded.
And there's the rub right there.
Yeah. But there are other issues involved here. One of the issues I would say is, can an individual actually declare war?
Ah, well, but the Duchy of Grand Fenwick.
Well, but even that was a
nation.
A tiny nation,
but a nation.
And if you don't know, if you've never seen or read the book, The Mouse That Roared,
yes,
I would rent it. or go down to the library and see if you
or can do a Netflix or whatever. Yeah, it's cute.
It's an interesting movie. Peter Sellers, you can't go wrong with a Peter Sellers movie. So, first of all, it seems to me that the Department of Justice made an extreme stretch.
Uh-huh.
On claiming that this was engaging in chemical warfare.
Well, it might have been a stretch, Chuck, but Miss Bond was convicted in a federal district court. She was convicted in a federal appellate court. And she countered at the United States Supreme Court under these grounds. She challenged her conviction that the Chemical Weapons Ban Treaty of 1997... it's implementing legislation, which happened in 1998, and which is the statute she's being charged under federally, can't rewrite the United States Constitution. Now what we have, Chuck, and this is something we talk about in our classes,
yep,
is the difference between the view of a constitution from an international law perspective versus a constitutional law perspective. This one is a boilerplate, Charles.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Because Mrs. Bond's attorneys are arguing from a constitutional law perspective, which looks at Article 6 of the Constitution, which is what we call the Supremacy Clause of the Constitution, and they clearly argue that any treaties made by the United States fall under and are subject to the limitations of the Constitution of the United States. Now, the federal prosecutors in this case are international law adherents, and they're taking the opposite view. And the opposite view is that treaties can supersede the Constitution's limitations because of their importance. Because although we have a constitutional provision on how to enter into a treaty, that once a treaty is effected, then the treaty it rides as an umbrella beyond the Constitution.
Well, let's read the clause in Article 6 that gives this power, and then talk about what the problems are with the arguments. First of all, this is Clause 2 of Article 6. This Constitution and the laws of the United States, which shall be made in pursuance thereof, semicolon.
Yes. And yes, the grammar and the punctuation are definitely important,
yeah,
here.
And all treaties made or which shall be made under the authority of the United States shall be the supreme law of the land, semicolon. And the judges in every state shall be bound thereby, anything in the Constitution or laws of any state to the contrary notwithstanding.
We see the Supremacy Clause, Charles, really says that federal law, the Constitution and the laws of the United States, supersede state laws and state constitutions in that respect.
Right.
But this portion about treaties, and the reason why you noted the semicolons in here, is that it's a continuing clause. The Constitution of the United States is the overarching cap on everything. The treaties have to be made in, and it says the laws of the United States made in pursuance thereof. Now, that hangs out there like a hanging curveball getting ready to be smacked out of the park by Barry Bonds. The international law adherents, what that does is that's a free pass. So they're like, well, as long as, you know, we did the treaty within the bounds of the Constitution, then it can supersede the Constitution. But that's not what it means.
No.
Pursuance means to follow after. In other words, to be subservient to. The laws of the United States have to be made within the constitutional framework or the constitutional limitations. The express writ of the Constitution must be followed for a, quote, law of the United States to have validity. And then treaties made under the authority. Now, and there's an interesting reason, and we bring this up in class. There's an interesting reason why that phrase is said just the way it is,
yes,
in the Constitution.
That's
read
right.
That last phrase about treaties again.
And all treaties made or which shall be made under the authority of the United States shall be the supreme law,
okay,
of the land.
All right. Made under the authority of the United States. Chuck, what's special about that particular kind of phrasing?
Well, okay. This is a little historical lesson.
Yes, it is.
Folks out there might remember that the Constitution took effect in 1789, but the United States became a country in 1776.
Right. Exactly.
So sometime between 13 years between 1776 and 1789, we're under a different Constitution.
Yes, the Articles of Confederation, but the Articles didn't come into effect until 1781.
Ah, but the Congress,
yes,
acting as a convention, basically operated under the Articles of Confederation from the time they were written, which was about 1777, as if they were ratified.
As if they were ratified, that's right.
Because the only thing really holding up the ratification was an argument over what would happen to Western lands that were held, large tracts of land that were held by states like Virginia
and Maryland.
Maryland didn't have Western lands.
But they wanted them.
Yeah, Connecticut actually also had large Western lands, and so did North Carolina. So there was a question on what would happen to those lands, and it wasn't until 1781, just before, in the spring before the final battle of the war,
yes,
at Yorktown,
yes,
which was in October. Basically Virginia said, okay, we'll cede it. And there's other things that came out of that, the Northwest Territory Ordinance, that kind of thing. But the bottom line is that the Congress, which was acting as a convention, essentially pretended like it was ratified and right. operated under it as a limiting document.
Right.
And that meant that the treaties, for instance, the peace treaty with Britain, which was basically negotiated in 1783, was all done under the Articles of Confederation. Well, with the Constitution taking effect in 1789, the Articles of Confederation were wiped away. That bond of union was dissolved. Well, what they were saying with this language was that the bond of union may be wiped away, but the treaty obligations are still intact.
Right. Now, what particular treaty would that have most glaringly been written for to make sure that it didn't get negated under the change?
Oh, definitely the peace treaty, because the peace treaty is what specifically granted individual independence to all 13 colonies.
That's right. So the treaty that they made with Great Britain after the War for Independence was the Treaty of Paris.
Yes.
If they hadn't have put that in there, there could have been a significant argument made that treaty was null and void because the form of government had changed.
Exactly.
So that language was put in there, and folks, that language was put in there not to say those treaties superseded the Constitution, by no means. I don't think any of our founders would have believed that, because they were all constitutional law scholars. But that treaties that were made prior to the document were not get nullified by the document. Not that the treaties would be higher law than the document, because according to our founders and according to the actual words on paper, this Constitution is the supreme law of the land.
That's
and
right.
Everything underneath of it is then the laws in the United States and then treaty. So even a treaty, according to the way our founders structured Article 6, even a treaty is subservient to the laws of the United States. Now, the big problem here, Chuck, and this is the problem in Bond versus United States, is that there are people in the federal government and in international law theory who want to say that a country can use a treaty to get around the limitations of a constitution. That they can use they can go and find a treaty, like we used the example in class. If you want to get rid of free speech in America, just go to a country that doesn't allow free speech, like Cambodia, and sign a treaty with them nullifying free speech between the two countries, and therefore, nice, neat, the First Amendment doesn't apply anymore.
There is a treaty
right
now that's attempting to be ratified. This treaty will not be ratified, by the way.
It may be ratified in absentia, if you know what I'm saying.
Possibly.
If this goes
it's
on.
The Small Arms Treaty.
Yes, that's right.
Now, the point, supposedly the Small Arms Treaty is to supposedly make it impossible for rebel groups to get small arms. Yeah. Oh,
sorry.
Please.
Sorry.
While we're dealing them out the back door, we're banning them at the front door. Here's the problem with that, Barry. First of all, that particular thing I just said.
Yes.
Second of all, it's really an attempt to ban the private ownership of arms in the United States of America.
Right. Yeah. It's basically trying to eliminate the Second Amendment by treaty.
Yes. Now, there's a problem with the Supremacy Clause, as we just laid out here.
Sure.
What we just laid out to you, that the supreme law of the land are the treaties and the Constitution. There's an issue with that, and that is called the Pursuance Clause.
There, indeed.
This Constitution and the laws of the United States, which shall be made in pursuance thereof.
Yes.
Now, what this woman, this Mrs. Bond, is arguing is that she has a 10th Amendment
right. Correct.
To not be tried at the federal level for this particular crime.
Right. Well, and the big problem with that is now they've put that argument out there, and the Supreme Court said, yes, 9-0, that she could have another trial. Now, what they, I think the specifics of it was that she could challenge her conviction under the 10th Amendment. In other words, they opened the door for that. 9-0 right. vote 2 years ago. However, she lost again at the district court level and at the appeals court level, who upheld her chemical weapons warfare
conviction yeah.
By the federal government. So now the justices, after having signaled and flagged that they were willing to listen to a 10th Amendment argument, now has one. And that's what they're hearing today. Now, I don't know where this is going to go, but if the court rules in favor of the federal prosecutors, we have basically said that any administration who can get enough votes in the Senate can change our form of government by a treaty.
That's exactly what it says, although it's being couched in a way that doesn't look like that.
Well, yeah, of course it's being couched that way.
Because let's see why she's making a 10th Amendment argument, and mm-hmm. I will dig that up, and I will read Article 10. The powers not delegated to the United States by the Constitution nor prohibited by it to the states are reserved to the states respectively or to the people.
So in other words, she's saying that since a treaty can't wipe out the constitutional protection of an individual to be tried in their own state for a state-level crime, the 10th Amendment applies because the federal government is prohibited from using that treaty to take away her rights. There's a Fourth and a Sixth Amendment argument in this too.
Oh well, there's also an Article 1, Section 8 argument.
Oh yeah, there are numerous arguments in this.
Article 1, Section 8 basically is the enumerated powers. There's no enumerated power to redefine war in order to make it one scorned woman who basically steals some stuff from the place she works and paints it on her mailbox and on her car.
Right.
That is not warfare by any stretch of the imagination. And basically, this is simply stretching the law to attempt to usurp state authority. That's why it's a 10th Amendment argument, is because the federal government has stepped in order to prosecute someone who, by the way, would probably, based on the evidence, have been convicted of the assault with deadly intent
right.
that she was charged with.
Right,
exactly. So why did the federal government feel the need to come in and try this case on this basis? And the only thing I can see is that they want to set a precedent in terms of, quote-unquote, terrorism.
Domestic terrorism, yes.
Domestic terrorism.
I thought the same thing.
And the fact is that this shows the folly of and how the Constitution is abrogated by that kind of
right.
thing. There is no act of domestic terrorism that it could not be handled at the state level where it occurred. And if you want to make a conspiracy case for an international case, that's another thing. Okay, well, they mm-hmm. planned it in New York and pulled it off in Kentucky.
Right.
Okay, now you've got to cross state lines, and that is a federal case.
Interstate commerce, yes.
It's an interstate case. But this kind of case is not.
No. Well, it is now.
Well, yeah.
Because the Third Circuit Court of Appeals, which heard her case originally and ruled in favor of the federal government, pulled a precedent from an interesting piece of case law that we actually talk about with our students in class, in our IOTC classes. The case was called Missouri versus Holland. Now, Chuck, this is a case from 1920, so we're looking at 93-year-old case law, okay? And what they're looking at is the fact that in that case, which was a issue with the state of Missouri and whether or not they had violated the Migratory Bird Treaty Act by allowing hunters to shoot Canadian geese, you know, within the state bounds, the court ruled almost infamously, that treaty law, in using the supremacy clause, that treaties were also the supreme law of the land, and that that trumped any state-level concern with the regard to the provision of a treaty. In other words, the 10th Amendment doesn't apply, according to this court decision. Now, we read this to our classes not specifically for that, but because of another part of the decision, which was rendered by Justice Oliver Wendell Holmes Jr., who is infamous. I mean, I think probably most every American somehow has heard of Oliver Wendell Holmes Jr. at some point in time in their life, you know?
Some would say famous. Others of us would say infamous. Yeah.
Yes, that's right. But in his opinion, the majority opinion, he wrote about this and said that the states don't have any 10th Amendment right when it comes to treaties, period. That supersedes the Constitution. Well, that's the argument that the Third Circuit Court. Now, the reason why we read this case to our students and the reason why we ask them to think about it is because of the other thing that Oliver Wendell Holmes said. And I'm going to read it, okay? And this is the quote directly from his opinion. Quote, "With regard to that," that is the nature of the Constitution, "we may add that when we are dealing with words that are also a constituent act," the Constitution, "like the Constitution of the United States,"
yeah,
he goes and says it, "we must realize that they," that's the founders, "have called into life a being the development of which could not have been foreseen completely by the most gifted of its begetters. It was enough for them to realize or to hope that they had created an organism. It has taken a century and has cost their successors much sweat and blood to preserve that they created a nation. The case before us," Missouri v. Holland, "must be considered in the light of our whole experience and not merely in that of what was said 100 years ago. The treaty in question does not contravene any prohibitory words to be found in the Constitution." Of course, the argument being, it's supreme, so it can't contravene, right, because it's higher. "The only question is whether it is forbidden by some invisible radiation from the general terms of the 10th Amendment. We must consider what this country has become in deciding what that amendment has reserved." Now, ladies and gentlemen, I hope I didn't lose you during that little soliloquy, but what we are talking about here was the first written opinion in United States judicial case law which specifically spelled out the living Constitution model.
The living, breathing Constitution. That's basically right. It expands
and grows like an organism
to meet the needs of the
time.
Of the time.
And that our founders were locked into their time and couldn't foresee all this stuff. And so therefore, their genius was not in creating the Constitution itself, but was in creating a document that could then be stretched and molded and changed by fiat by these justices in black robes who were taking the pulse of the nation, who know what this country has become, in order to determine what the words written over 100 years ago by this case would reserve. So in other words, he's saying the 10th Amendment doesn't say what you think it says because, well, we've evolved.
Yeah, basically.
And folks, we've been fighting that fight now for almost 100 years. I mean, it was originated here. Boom. You know, this case basically threw down the gauntlet and said we got two views of the Constitution of the United States. One is it's a living document, which means it has to change and grow and mutate, and words don't mean what they mean in black and white because we now have a postmodern viewpoint of it, and that words that are constituent act, the Constitution, has to be able to be molded for whatever we feel is right now. And then you have the other viewpoint, which is the original intent view, which says the founders meant exactly what they meant. They put it down in black and white, and words have fixed meanings, and that is how we are supposed to stay within boundaries within our government.
Now, when we ran this past one of our very smart students, who are, by the way, mostly homeschoolers in our Mount Vernon class, when we asked them what this was, what did they say?
Well, they said it's postmodernism.
Postmodernism.
They immediately went right to it.
They knew what it was. This is postmodernism, that basically words don't mean what you think they mean. They mean whatever the user thinks they mean, or the hearer. And that's where you run into trouble. Because sometimes the user of the word means one thing, and the hearer thinks he wants to hear something else. And so what does that do to communication?
It totally destroys it. It
absolutely destroys it.
And it also puts power in the hand of the definer.
Yes.
He who defines the terms wins.
Now, just for fun, this was Missouri v. Holland in
1920.
What did Missouri do about this ruling?
Missouri basically nullified that federal ruling by ignoring it completely.
Yeah, that's exactly what they did.
But I don't think Miss Bond is going to have the same benefit. I doubt very seriously she or the state of Pennsylvania are going to basically not she won't be kept from being tossed in a federal penitentiary if she loses this case.
No. Now, that probably actually should happen, but it won't.
Yes.
And the fact is that this is one of those places where you say, okay, she's guilty of sin, but you don't want to see her get off scot-free. And I don't think she would have gotten off scot-free had the feds allowed the state of Pennsylvania
to do what they needed to do.
To do what they needed to do, and that was try her under state law.
So whether or not you like Carol Bond and you like the fact that she used a toxic chemical to try to off her romantic opponent for her husband's affections, the key point is the federal prosecutors are trying to say that this treaty supersedes your protections under the Constitution, under the First Amendment, the Tenth Amendment, and of course we're looking at the Fourth Amendment and the Sixth Amendment of this as well, including broad swaths of the Constitution itself, because they believe that treaties, when ratified, supersede everything. And so, ladies and gentlemen, can you imagine an administration who has a majority in the Senate who gets a ruling from the Supreme Court saying, yes, you're right, you can use treaties to supersede the Constitution?
It's a nightmare. It's an unfolding nightmare, and it's basically a way of folding us into essentially a world government.
Right. Well, and the big problem is, Chuck, we won't know the disposition of this until probably sometime next spring.
Right.
Because they'll hear the arguments today on Tuesday. And then it'll be 2 or 3 weeks, and then they'll sit down and they'll decide who's going to write the majority. They'll vote and they'll decide who writes the majority opinion. But that opinion won't be finalized or released until their spring term, sometime in May or June
right.
of next year.
Right.
So, ladies and gentlemen, Lord willing, and we're still around, we'll keep you informed on what happens with this case, because this is a significant, fork in the road. We're either going to go down the road of staying and adhering to the Constitution and its protections of individuals and states, or we're going to say that a federal administration can do whatever they want to as long as they can get another country to go along with it and they sign a treaty and ratify it.
That being said, let's talk about this just for a very short remaining time.
Sure.
We are currently organizing a class in Westerville, Ohio.
Yes.
To teach our Institute on the Constitution class. It's already set up. It's going to meet Thursday night starting
January the 16th.
January the 16th from 7:15 to 9:15 p.m. at Grace Fellowship Church on Paris Boulevard in Westerville. That's the south side of town.
Now, folks can sign up for the class because we do require pre-registration. If you register before January the 1st, you can get in at our standard rate, which is $60 per student.
I've set it up later than that. I'm giving them till the Monday before the class starts.
Okay, fine. So the 13th then.
Yep.
Okay, so we moved it to the 13th, but you can sign up, and that gets you your materials, your student guide, 2 books that we use in the class, a pocket constitution, and 12 weeks worth of live instruction from Mr. Michaelis and I. All for $60. Now, if you sign up before that, after that Monday, it's $75 because we have to know how many books we need to order
right.
in order to make sure we've got enough for the class. Again, this is going to start in January 2014 on the 16th. It's going to go every Thursday night for 12 weeks. So January, February, March, we're going to be into like first couple of weeks of April.
First week of April,
finishing this up. But it is Institute on the Constitution. You can go over to Chuck's website at campamerican.com or at principledpolicy.com and sign up for the class. Now, we've already got people starting to sign up, and we're going to probably have to limit the space on this class to probably no more than 40. I think that's about our size we've got for the class.
40 is about all we can handle.
It's about all we can handle in this class. So if you want to learn how to utilize and read the Constitution and utilize it as a tool to protect your liberties, sign up ASAP. Again, principledpolicy.com. Sign up for our Institute on the Constitution class in Westerville starting in January.
That being said, we're out of time. Join us again next week for another Principles and Policies.